better strategic result, it will remain an unknowable. Because moralists in these matters are always driven by righteous passion, whenever you disagree with them, you are, by definition, immoral and deserve no quarter, whereas realists, precisely because they are used to conflict, are less likely to overreact to it. Realists know that passion and wise policy rarely flow together. The late diplomat Richard Holbrooke was a stunning exception to this rule. Realists adhere to the belief of the mid-20th century University of Chicago political scientist Hans Morgenthau, who wrote that one must work with the base forces of human nature, not against them. Thus, realists accept the human material at hand in any given place, however imperfect that material may be. To wit, you can't go around toppling regimes just because you don't like them. Realism, adds Morgenthau, appeals to historical precedent rather than to abstract principles of justice, and aims at the realization of the lesser evil rather than of the absolute good. No group of people internalized such tragic realizations better than Republican presidents during the Cold War. Dwight Eisenhower, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, and George H.W. Bush all practiced amorality, realism, restraint, and humility in foreign affairs, if not all the time. It is their sensibility that should guide us now. Eisenhower represented a pragmatic compromise within the Republican Party between isolationists and rabid anti-communists. All of these men supported repressive, undemocratic regimes in the Third World in support of a favorable balance of power against the Soviet Union. Nixon accepted the altogether brutal regimes in the Soviet Union and Red China as legitimate, even as he balanced one against the other. Reagan spoke the Wilsonian language of moral rearmament, even as he awarded the key levers of bureaucratic power to realists like Caspar Weinberger, George Shultz, and Frank Carlucci, whose effect regarding policy was to temper Reagan's rhetoric. The elder Bush did not break relations with China after the Tiananmen uprising, nor did he immediately pledge support for Lithuania after that brave little country declared its independence, for fear of antagonizing the Soviet military. It was caution and restraint on Bush's part that helped bring the Cold War to a largely peaceful, and therefore moral, conclusion. In some of these policies, the difference between amorality and morality was, to paraphrase Joseph Conrad in Lord Jim, no more than the thickness of a sheet of paper. And that is precisely the point. Foreign policy at its best is subtle, innovative, contradictory, and truly bold only on occasion, aware as its most disciplined practitioners are of the limits of American power. That is heartrending, simply because calls to alleviate suffering will in too many instances go unanswered. For the essence of tragedy is not the triumph of evil over good, so much as the triumph of one good over another that causes suffering. 4. Elegant Decline. The Navy's Rising Importance. The Atlantic, November 2007. Beware pendulum swings. Before 9/11, not enough U.S. generals believed that the future of war was unconventional and tied to global anarchy. They insisted on having divisions to fight against, not ragtag groups of religious warriors who, as it turned out, fought better than state armies in the Muslim world ever did. Now, the Pentagon is consumed by a focus on urban warfare and counterinsurgency. Inside military circles, the development of culturally adroit foreign area officers, FAOs, and the learning of exotic languages have become the rage. My own warnings about anarchy, the coming anarchy, February 1994, Atlantic, and my concentration on FAOs and Army Special Forces in recent books may have helped this trend. But have we pushed it too far? We may finally master the art of counterinsurgency just in time for it to recede in importance. History suggests that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan will be imperfect guideposts to conflicts ahead. The quaint Franco-Prussian War of 1870 to 1871 gave no intimation of World War I. Neither World War II nor Korea prepared us for Vietnam, which was more similar to the Philippine War of 1899 to 1902 than to its immediate predecessors. The ease of the Gulf War provided no hint of what an ordeal the Iraq War would be. Today, while we remain fixated on street fighting in Baghdad, the militaries of China, India, South Korea, and Japan are modernizing, and Russia has maintained and subsidized its military research and development base by selling weapons to China and others. Though counterinsurgency will remain a core part of our military doctrine, the Pentagon does not have the luxury of planning for one military future. It must plan for several. Regular wars between major states could be as frequent in the 21st century as they were in the 20th. In his 2005 book, Another Bloody Century, the British scholar Colin Gray, a professor of international politics and strategic studies at the University of Reading, explains convincingly that these future wars will not require any manifestation of insanity by political leaders, nor even an aberration from normal statecraft, but may come about merely because of what Thucydides recognized as fear, honor, and interest. Wars between the United States and a Sino-Russian axis, or between the United States and a coalition of rogue states, are just two of the scenarios Gray imagines. Are we prepared to fight these wars? Our Army and Marine Corps together constitute the most battle-hardened regular land force in the world. But it has been a long time since our Navy has truly fought another Navy, or our Air Force another Air Force. In the future, they could be tested to the same extent that the Army and Marine Corps have been. The current catchphrase is boots on the ground. In the future, it could be holes in the water. Democracy and supremacy undermine the tragic sense required for long-range planning. A peaceful, gain-loving nation, like the United States, is not far-sighted, and far-sightedness is needed for adequate military preparation, especially in these days, warned Navy Captain Alfred Thayer Mahan in 1890, a time when, although the Panama Canal was soon to be built and World War I lay just over the horizon, America was still preoccupied with land-based westward expansion. Wounded Knee, the last battle of the Indian Wars, was fought that year. Mahan notwithstanding, too few strategists at the time were thinking seriously about sea power. Today, we are similarly obsessed with dirty land wars, and our 300-ship navy is roughly half the size it was in the mid-1980s. A great navy is like oxygen. You notice it only when it is gone. But the strength of a nation's sea presence, more than any other indicator, has throughout history often been the best barometer of that nation's power and prospects. Those far-distant, storm-beaten ships upon which Napoleon's Grand Army never looked stood between it and the dominion of the world, Mahan wrote, describing how the British Royal Navy had checked Napoleon's ambitions. In our day, carrier strike groups, floating in international waters only a few miles off enemy territory, require no visas or exit strategies. Despite the quagmire of Iraq, we remain the greatest outside power in the Middle East because of our ability to project destructive fire from warships in the Indian Ocean and its tributary waters, such as the Persian Gulf. Our sea power allows us to lose a limited war on land without catastrophic consequences. The Navy, together with the Air Force, constitutes our insurance policy. The Navy also plays a crucial role as the bus driver for most of the Army's equipment whenever the Army deploys overseas. Army units can't forward deploy anywhere in significant numbers without a national debate. Not so the Navy. Forget the cliché about the essence of the Navy being tradition. I've spent enough time with junior officers and enlisted sailors on Pacific deployments to know that the essence of our Navy is operations, disaster relief, tracking Chinese subs, guarding sea lanes, and so forth. American sailors don't care what the mission is, as long as there is one, and the farther forward, the better. The seminal event for the U.S. Navy was John Paul Jones's interdiction of the British during the Revolutionary War, which occurred off Yorkshire on the other side of the Atlantic. During the quasi-war that President John Adams waged against France from 1798 to 1800, U.S. warships protected American merchant vessels off what is today Indonesia. American warships operated off North Africa in the First Barbary War of 1801 to 1805. The War of 1812 found the Navy as far down the globe as the coast of Brazil and as far up as the North Cape of Scandinavia. Peter Swartz, an expert at the Center for Naval Analyses, observes that because operating thousands of miles from home ports is so ingrained in U.S. naval tradition, no one thinks it odd that even the Coast Guard has ships in service from Greenland to South America. Great navies help preserve international stability. When the British Navy began to decline, the vacuum it left behind helped engender the competition among major powers that led to World War I. After the U.S. Navy was forced to depart Subic Bay in the Philippines in 1992, piracy quintupled in the Southeast Asian archipelago, which includes one of the world's busiest waterways, the Strait of Malacca. In an age when 90% of global commerce travels by sea, and 95% of our imports and exports from outside North America do the same, even as that trade volume is set to double by 2020, and when 75% of the world's population is clustered within 200 miles of the sea, the relative decline of our Navy is a big, dangerous fact to which our elites appear blind. The end of the Mahanian century? The best way to understand the tenuousness of our grip on hard military power, to say nothing of soft diplomatic power, is to understand our situation at sea. This requires an acquaintance with two books published a century ago, Mahan's The Influence of Sea Power Upon History, 1660 to 1783, which was written in 1890, and Julian S. Corbett's Some Principles of Maritime Strategy, which came out in 1911. Few books have had more influence on military policy than Mahan's. It affected the thinking of Presidents William McKinley and Theodore Roosevelt, as well as that of Germany's Kaiser Wilhelm II, and it helped prompt the naval buildup before World War I. Mahan showed that because the sea is the great commons of civilization, naval power, to protect merchant fleets, had always been the determining factor in European political struggles. The strength of his argument lay less in its originality than in its comprehensiveness, achieved by numerous examples. He pointed out that there were no great sea battles in the Second Punic War, because Rome's mastery of the Mediterranean was a deciding factor in Carthage's defeat. He noted that George Washington partly attributed America's victory in its War for Independence to France's control of the seas, even as several decades earlier, France had lost the Seven Years' War partly because of its neglect of sea power. Mahan believed in concentrating national naval forces in search of the decisive battle. For him, success was about sinking the other fleet. Mahan's aggressive sensibility perfectly matched the temperament of Theodore Roosevelt. As a result, it was in the quiet years before World War I that America became a great sea power, and consequently a great power. Julian Corbett, a British historian, did not so much disagree with Mahan as offer a subtler approach, placing greater emphasis on doing more with less. Corbett asserted that just because one nation has lost control of the sea, another nation has not necessarily gained it. A naval coalition that may appear weak and dispersed can, if properly constituted, have a reality of strength. He called this a fleet in being, a collection of ships that can quickly coalesce into a unified fleet when necessary. This fleet in being wouldn't need to dominate or sink other fleets. It could be effective by seizing bases and policing choke points. Such a deceptively able fleet, Corbett argued, should pursue an active and vigorous life in the conduct of limited defense, by, for example, carrying out harassing operations. As it happened, Corbett's book came out after the British Royal Navy had reduced its worldwide presence by leveraging the growing sea power of its allies, Japan and the United States. 100 years later, the Mahanian century has ended. The period of 1890 to 1989 was about dominance, controlling vast oceanic spaces by making sure your national navy had more ships than those of your competitors. This era reached its zenith in 1945, when the U.S. Navy and its vast fleet of supply ships numbered 6,700. With no peer competitor in sight, the President and Congress moved quickly to cut that navy, along with the standing army, considerably. By 1950, the United States had only 634 ships. The drawdown helped set the stage for the Revolt of the Admirals, when a group of officers warned the nation of calamities ahead. Indeed, 2 decades later, the Soviet Navy would be a near-peer competitor. But in a 1954 article in Proceedings, the Journal of the U.S. Naval Institute in Annapolis, Maryland, a young Harvard academic named Samuel P. Huntington told the Navy not to feel sorry for itself. The resources which a service is able to obtain in a democratic society are a function of the public support of that service. The service has the responsibility to develop this necessary support, and it can only do this if it possesses a strategic concept which clearly formulates its relationship to the national security. Huntington recommended that the Navy emphasize its ability to support ground troops from the sea. Any battles with the Soviet Union were likely to be on land, so the Navy needed to play up the job it could do in a war with a great land power. The Navy took Huntington's advice, and it worked. For the remainder of the Cold War, the Navy was able to hold the line at roughly 600 ships, in part by arguing for its importance in supporting a ground war against the Soviet Union and its allies. It would be the Navy's job to get soldiers to the fight and to soften up the battlefield with offshore firepower. In 1991, the Gulf War provided a live-action demonstration of this capacity. Even so, by 1997, post-Cold War budget cuts had reduced the Navy to 365 ships. In the Quadrennial Defense Review of that year, the Pentagon established a red line of 300 ships, below which the Navy would not go. Of course, the 300-ship Navy could still, in the words of Robert O. Work, Vice President for Strategic Studies at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessment in Washington, pound the snot out of primitive challengers like Iraq, Iran, and North Korea, because the precision revolution in weaponry enabled, for instance, a single wire-guided missile from a U.S. destroyer to accomplish what in Vietnam had required wave after wave of carrier-based planes. Still, the fewer vessels you have, the riskier each deployment, because a ship can't be in two places at once. Due to the rapid increase in shipborne trade, globalization favors large navies that protect trade and tanker routes. Additionally, while the United States remains a great naval power, it is no longer a maritime power. That is, we don't have much of a merchant fleet left to support our warships in an emergency. We've been priced out of the shipbuilding market by cheap labor countries in Asia. All of this puts us in a precarious position. History shows that powerful competitor navies can easily emerge out of nowhere in just a few decades. The vast majority of American ships that saw combat in World War II had not even been planned before the spring of 1941. The Indian Navy, which may soon be the third largest in the world, was not on many people's radar screens at the close of the Cold War, nor, for that matter, was the now-expanding Chinese submarine fleet. Robert Work told me that he believes the eventual incorporation of Taiwan into China will have the effect that the Battle of Wounded Knee had on the United States. It will psychologically close an era of national consolidation for the Chinese. thereby dramatically redirecting their military energies outward, beyond their coastal waters. Tellingly, whereas the U.S. Navy pays homage to Mahan by naming buildings after him, the Chinese avidly read him. The Chinese are the Mahanians now. Then there is the Japanese Navy, which now operates 117 warships, including 16 submarines. In a sense, we're back to 1890, when a spark of naval competition among rising powers like Japan, Germany, and the United States left Britain unable to maintain its relative advantage. The Thousand-Ship Navy. By necessity, the American Navy is turning from Mahan to Corbett. Where the old maritime strategy focused on sea control, Admiral Michael Mullen, the Chief of Naval Operations, recently promoted to Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said last year, the new one must recognize that the economic tide of all nations rises not when the seas are controlled by one nation, but rather when they are made safe and free for all. He went on, I'm after that proverbial thousand-ship navy, a fleet in being, if you will, comprised of all freedom-loving nations, standing watch over the seas, standing watch over each other. Subtract the platitudes, and it's clear that Admiral Mullen is squaring a number of circles to contend with the difficult reality he's up against. A grand maritime coalition that policed the seas and provided disaster relief would allow for such possibilities as joint American-Chinese anti-piracy patrols in Malsindo, the Malaysia-Singapore-Indonesia archipelagic region, as an American Navy acronym labels it. In fact, national navies tend to cooperate better than national armies, partly because sailors are united by a kind of fellowship of the sea, born of their shared experience facing violent natural forces. Such coalitions would likely get along better than the land-based ones we have seen in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Kosovo. Requirements for membership would be minimal. Any navy could join, provided it were willing to share information. Leading a cooperative international enterprise like this to interdict terrorists, pirates, and smugglers in coastal waters and to deter rogue states would help the United States improve its deteriorating reputation in the wake of Iraq. Mullen's emphasis on a coalition of freedom-loving nations is itself an indication of diminished resources. During the Cold War, we had crucial naval allies whose bases could always be depended upon, Japan, Great Britain, Denmark, Norway, Iceland, and several others. With their help, we held the Soviet Navy in check under the polar ice. But given current public opinion in Europe, perhaps the only one of these allies we can rely on in the future is Japan, which, as an island civilization still hated throughout Asia and beset with security dilemmas of limited interest to Europeans, may be the loneliest country in the world except for Israel. Experts I spoke to for this article worried about the prospective loss of Allied basing and advocated sea basing. One of the Navy's earliest proposed designs was a device resembling a self-powered oil rig with massive platforms for UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles, and other air assets. With no core group of allies, commerce has to be protected by all, for all. That's no easy challenge. Whereas airplanes are monitored and regulated from takeoff to landing, merchant ships are on their own in the anarchic seas. But in a post-9/11 world, with the possibility of nuclear terrorism abetted by ocean-based piracy and smuggling, the anarchy needs to be quelled, and the seas and the ports policed. Hence the benefits of a multi-nation piracy patrol. Stanley Weeks is a Washington-based naval and defense policy analyst for a Fortune 500 commercial consulting company. Over the course of his career, he has done everything from mentoring the new Albanian Navy to advising U.S. combatant commanders about how to defend against missiles. When I spoke to him in his office in McLean, Virginia, he told me about other possibilities for Admiral Mullen's thousand-ship fleet in being. Boots on the ground in most cases is a loser, Weeks said. On land, we're not playing to our advantage because there is an endless demographic supply of young male religious fanatics. He emphasized that naval operations can lower America's profile since they attract less attention than army operations, making our military less vulnerable to media attacks, and therefore also making it easier to carry out operations that might otherwise become lightning rods for criticism. Offshore maritime capability also enables us to take out selected individuals and insert small groups of special forces, Weeks says, adding that leveraging other powers by operating as part of an international 1,000-ship navy would certainly help with all this. A multinational fleet in being would also lead to greater intelligence sharing and allow us greater forward presence closer to enemy shores. This would make it easier to identify key targets. In fact, the 1,000-ship multinational navy is essentially the seagoing equivalent of counterinsurgency. But while the 1,000-ship navy would help cut down on smuggling and piracy, and possibly terrorism, it doesn't really deal with the basic strategic function of the U.S. Navy, the need to offer a serious, inviolable instrument for inflicting great punishment, a stare-down capability. Nor does it address the need to quickly transport troops and equipment to distant conflicts. The Navy is not primarily about low-level raiding, piracy patrols, and riverine warfare, Jim Thomas, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, told me. If we delude ourselves into thinking that it is, we're finished as a great power. Piracy, for example, has been a scourge for hundreds of years in some of the very same places we say it cannot be tolerated, like off the Horn of Africa or in archipelagic Southeast Asia. As the late Vice Admiral and Navy futurist Arthur Sabrowski once told me, with a dismissive wave of his arm, piracy is just part of the noise. No matter how the Pentagon spins it, the reality is that development of a 1,000-ship international navy is not a way of maintaining our current strength. Rather, it's a way of elegantly managing American decline. But let's remember that while the relative decline of the British Royal Navy helped produce World War I, Britain and its allies still won that war, thanks in some measure to sea power, and that Britain would go on to triumph in an even greater world war 2 decades later. Our own growing relative weakness need not mean that our adversaries gain advantage. Decline can be overrated. The Weary Titan. As noted, today we have only half the nearly 600 ships that the U.S. Navy had in the 1980s, when it was directed by Secretary of the Navy John Layman. He observes that now, because we are building only 5 ships per year, we're on the way to a 150-ship navy. This attrition is partly a result of the high cost of the war in Iraq and the shrinkage of discretionary funds in the national budget, but it's also a function of the procurement process itself. The building of naval platforms offers a case study in how a vast and aged bureaucratic system is subject to disease and calcification, which are in part what doomed pharaonic Egypt, Mayan Central America, and Soviet Russia. To get this bureaucracy to agree on a new class of ship can take years, even decades, of studies and committee meetings in which slowing down the process is easy and taking even the smallest risk is hard. Consequently, by the time a ship is launched, it is already dated. Yet, because the ship must be equipped with every weapons system conceivable, the cost remains high. To leave any weapons system out is to make the ship, to some degree, more vulnerable, and that means risk. The Arleigh Burke-class guided missile destroyer, on which I was embedded in 2005, cost nearly $1 billion. The new DDG-1000 Zumwalt-class destroyer, envisioned in one form or another for 12 years and beset with delays, could end up costing $3 billion a ship, if any get built. The new Gerald R. Ford-class aircraft carriers could cost a whopping $8 billion each, not including $6 billion of research and development costs. History can be cruel to such a geologic pace. This slowness is a recipe for vulnerability and nasty strategic surprise. We have a capital-intensive navy consisting of vessels that cost tens of billions of dollars and that must therefore each deploy for decades if they are to return the investment. Yet all a future peer competitor like China need do to greatly devalue our fleet is to improve its ballistic missile technology to the point where we're forced to move our carriers, say 100 miles east of their present positions off the Asian mainland, to keep them out of missile range. Worse, a nuclear radiation device arriving in a container in the harbor at, say, Norfolk, Virginia, could render these multi-billion dollar platforms suddenly unusable. The coming technological era of precision and stealth will not be friendly to gargantuan objects like carriers. Consider the supercavitation torpedo, a torpedo that launches from a small boat and, by its ability to create a cushion of air between it and the surrounding water, can travel at 200 knots. Regular torpedoes can travel at only 35 knots and immobilize a carrier on detonation. Fortunately, our defense bureaucracy is slowly rising to the challenge, not by eliminating such threats, but by diminishing them. For instance, the new Ford-class carriers will be built with laser guns to kill incoming missiles, anti-torpedo torpedoes to deal with supercavitation technology, and electric catapults for launching UAVs in case fighter jets with their human pilots give way to enhanced remote-controlled predators that can be refueled in the air. Decline can be imperceptible, but if you think that what I have been describing does not constitute decline, consider the financial burden of sustaining this navy. Admiral Mullen was hanging on by his fingernails, trying to keep current projects going, according to one expert. It would take a Chinese-perpetrated 9/11 to give us the budget we need, the same expert told me, and the Chinese would never be that stupid. They will bleed us slowly by just doing what they're doing. On October 26, 2006, a Chinese Song-class attack submarine, equipped with Russian-made wake-homing torpedoes, reportedly stalked the USS Kitty Hawk carrier strike group in the Pacific. The sub boldly surfaced within firing range before being detected only 5 miles from the carrier itself. That incident might prove to be a better harbinger of the future than anything going on in Iraq. A second incident this past January provided another augury. When the Chinese destroyed an aging weather satellite with a missile-launched interceptor, they ended 2 decades of restraint over the militarization of space, as Vice Admiral John G. Morgan Jr., Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Information Plans and Strategy, told me. According to Stratfor, a consulting company that analyzes intelligence, the Chinese are developing a space warfare capability that could allow them to limit U.S. naval power without a massive naval buildup of their own by threatening our satellite-based intelligence gathering and weapons systems. The danger isn't China per se. China's actions are merely a premonition of a future that will favor nations with dynamic startup defense bureaucracies less careful and doubt-ridden than our own, unburdened by layers of committees and commissions, and willing to buy, or steal, cutting-edge technology. To grasp what our military is up against, think of our defense bureaucracy as a great metropolitan newspaper, proud of its editorial oversight, accuracy, and formal English usage, yet besieged and occasionally humiliated by bloggers whose usage is sloppy and whose fact-checking is weak, sometimes non-existent. The paper soldiers on, winning awards and affecting the national debate, even as each half-decade its opinion carries less weight. Now think of an $8 billion Ford-class carrier, surprised by dozens of jet skis ridden by Iranians armed with shoulder-fired missiles, a scenario one expert described to me. Such an attack wouldn't destroy the carrier, but it might kill sailors and damage some of the radar and planes on deck, worth millions of dollars. Imagine the headlines. Riding through the Strait of Malacca with a carrier strike group not long ago, I saw how easy it is for small fishing boats to draw suddenly alongside. Another likely future scenario our Navy may have to confront, described to me by Ronald O'Rourke of the Congressional Research Service, is so distributive and networked that it's reminiscent of the Borg aliens in Star Trek The Next Generation episodes, who are able, because of their collective mind, to simultaneously experience what only one of them witnesses. Instead of one big sonar device on a warship, there would be hundreds or thousands of hydrophones floating all over the ocean, each the size of a soda can, listening to submarines and sending information simultaneously. And if the United States develops such technology, there is no guarantee that we could keep it from the open market. Because of new surveillance measures, you could have whole zones of the ocean where you are unable to operate safely on the surface, Donald Henry, special assistant to the director of the Pentagon's Office of Net Assessment, told me. Technology and the risk of unconventional attacks could drive navies underwater unless carrier strike groups are protected by something we don't have yet. The faster technology progresses, the less likely that people will play by our rules. Meanwhile, as costs drive us toward that 150-ship Navy, we may need to delegate some tasks to private naval companies, in the same way that private contractors have been used on land in Iraq and Afghanistan. According to Navy Lieutenant Commander Claude Berube, who teaches at the U.S. Naval Academy, in an emergency we might even issue letters of marque, the way we did during the Revolutionary War, giving privateers the legal authority to act in our defense, allowing privateers to help with, say, the drug interdiction effort in the Caribbean would enable uniformed sailors to concentrate on the Pacific and Indian Oceans. More submarines might seem like a quick fix for many of these challenges. They operate under the surface. They are moving underwater intelligence factories, able to listen to cell phone conversations on land. They can launch missiles at targets on shore. Some are now being refitted so that they can clandestinely deliver special operations teams onto beaches. But the catch is that they are expensive. Each fast-attack Los Angeles-class submarine costs easily more than $1 billion in today's dollars, despite having much less general firepower than a comparably priced Arleigh Burke-class destroyer. Today, the United States devotes 4.38% of its annual gross domestic product to defense. Before the Iraq War, it was 3.5%. Although two dozen or so countries spend more on defense than we do relative to GDP, we still spend more in absolute terms than much of the rest of the world combined. But if we are to maintain our current relative military advantage, we will have to spend at even higher rates. Admiral Morgan, the Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Information Plans and Strategy, told me that to maintain our naval primacy, we may need to devote close to 5% of gross domestic product, assuming a growing economy, to defense. Yet it's unclear whether the American public will abide that. During the Cold War, our 600-ship Navy needed to be in only three places in force: the Atlantic and Pacific flanks of the Soviet Union, and the Mediterranean. We sometimes subcontracted out less important tropical sea lanes to other free world navies. In this, Admiral Mullen's 1,000-ship fleet in being does have a recent precedent. Now we need to cover the Earth with less than half that number of ships. Decline can never be admitted as such until a rival makes demonstrable inroads into your power. But naval trends now appear to buttress political and economic ones that suggest we are indeed headed for a world with multiple competing powers. Of course, admirals will continue to march to Capitol Hill and declare that no matter the size of the budget, they will succeed in every mission. Managing decline requires a degree of self-delusion, as Aaron Friedberg put it in his 1988 book, The Weary Titan, Britain and the Experience of Relative Decline, 1895 to 1905. British statesmen, Friedberg observed, continued to talk as if nothing of any significance had occurred, even as they abandoned worldwide sea supremacy. Abandoning supremacy was, in Friedberg's view, a prudent and sensible strategy, given the economic and political realities of the time. And it didn't stop Britain from helping to save the world in succeeding decades. We could do much worse. 5. When North Korea Falls. The Atlantic, October 2006. The abbreviation for North Korea used by American military officers says it all. KFR, the Kim Family Regime. It is a regime whose demonization by the American media and policymakers has obscured some vital facts. North Korea's founder, Kim Il-sung, was not merely a dreary Stalinist tyrant. As defectors from his country will tell you, he was also a popular anti-Japanese guerrilla leader in the mold of Enver Hoxha, the Stalinist tyrant of Albania, who led his countrymen in a successful insurgency against the Nazis. Nor is his son Kim Jong-il anything like the childish psychopath parodied in the film Team America World Police. It's true that Kim Jong-il was once a playboy, but he has evolved into a canny operator. Andrei Lankoff, a professor of history at South Korea's Kumin University in Seoul, says that under different circumstances, Kim might have actually become the successful Hollywood film producer that regime propaganda claims he already is. Kim Jong-il's succession was aided by the link that his father had established in the North Korean mind between the Kim family regime and the Chosun dynasty, which ruled the Korean peninsula for 500 years, starting in the late 14th century. Expertly tutored by his father, Kim consolidated power and manipulated the Chinese, the Americans, and the South Koreans into subsidizing him throughout the 1990s. And Kim is hardly impulsive. He has the equivalent of think tanks studying how best to respond to potential attacks from the United States and South Korea. Attacks that themselves would be reactions to crises cleverly instigated by the North Korean government in Pyongyang. The regime constitutes an extremely rational bunch of killers, Lankoff says. Yet for all Kim's canniness, there is evidence that he may be losing his edge. And that may be reason to worry. Totalitarian regimes close to demise are apt to get panicky and do rash things. The weaker North Korea gets, the more dangerous it becomes. The question that should be of greatest concern to the U.S. military in the Pacific, and the question that will likely determine the global balance of power in Asia for generations, is what happens when North Korea collapses? The nightmare after Iraq. On the Korean Peninsula, the Cold War has never ended. On the somber, seaweed-toned border dividing the two Koreas, amid the cries of egrets and Manchurian cranes, I observed South Korean soldiers standing frozen in Taekwondo-ready positions, their fists clenched and forearms tightened, staring into the faces of their North Korean counterparts. Each side picks its tallest, most intimidating soldiers for the task. They are still short by American standards. In the immediate aftermath of the Korean War, the South raised a 328-foot flagpole. The North responded with a 525-foot pole, then put a flag on it whose dry weight is 595 pounds. The North built a two-story building in the joint security area at Panmunjom. The South built a three-story one. The North then added another story to its building. The land of one-upmanship is how one U.S. Army sergeant describes the DMZ, or Demilitarized Zone. The two sides once held a meeting in Panmunjom that went on for 11 hours. Because there was no formal agreement about when to take a bathroom break, neither side budged. The meeting became known as the Battle of the Bladders. In other divided countries of the 20th century, Vietnam, Germany, Yemen, the forces of unity ultimately triumphed. But history suggests that unification does not happen through a calibrated political process in which the interests of all sides are respected. Rather, it tends to happen through a cataclysm of events that, piles of white papers and war gaming exercises notwithstanding, catches experts by surprise. Given that North Korea's army of 1.2 million soldiers has been increasingly deployed toward the South Korean border, the Korean Peninsula looms as potentially the next American military nightmare. In 1980, 40% of North Korean combat forces were deployed south of Pyongyang near the DMZ. By 2003, more than 70% were. As the saying goes among American soldiers, there is no peacetime in the ROK. ROK is military speak for the Republic of Korea. One has merely to observe the Patriot missile batteries, the reinforced concrete hangars, and the blast barriers at the U.S. Air Force bases at Osan and Kunsan, south of Seoul, which are as heavily fortified as any bases in Iraq, to be aware of this. A Marine in Okinawa told me, "North Korea is not some third-rate Middle Eastern conventional army. These brainwashed Asians, as he crudely put it, will stand and fight." American soldiers in Korea refer to the fighting on the peninsula between 1950 and 1953 as the First Korean War. The implicit assumption is that there will be a second. This helps explain why Korea may be the most dismal place in the world for U.S. troops to be deployed, worse in some ways than Iraq. While I traveled on the peninsula, numerous members of the combat arms community, both air and infantry, told me that they would rather be in Iraq or Afghanistan than in Korea, which constitutes the worst of all military worlds. Soldiers and airmen often live on a grueling wartime schedule, with constant drills, and yet they also have to put up with the official folderol that is part of all peacetime bases, the saluting and inspections that fall by the wayside in war zones, where the only thing that matters is how well you fight. The weather on the peninsula is lousy, too. The winds charging down from Siberia make the winters unbearably frigid, and the monsoons coming off the Pacific Ocean make the summers hot and humid. The dust blowing in from the Gobi Desert doesn't help. The threat from north of the DMZ is formidable. North Korea boasts 100,000 well-trained special operations forces and one of the world's largest biological and chemical arsenals. It has stockpiles of anthrax, cholera, and plague, as well as 8 industrial facilities for producing chemical agents, any of which could be launched at Seoul by the Army's conventional artillery. If the governing infrastructure in Pyongyang were to unravel, the result could be widespread lawlessness, compounded by the guerrilla mentality of the Kim family regime's armed forces, as well as mass migration out of and within North Korea. In short, North Korea's potential for anarchy is equal to that of Iraq, and the potential for the deployment of weapons of mass destruction, either during or after pre-collapse fighting, is far greater. For a harbinger of the kind of chaos that looms on the peninsula, consider Albania, which was for some years the most anarchic country in post-communist Eastern Europe, save for war-torn Yugoslavia. On a visit to Albania before the Stalinist regime there finally collapsed, I saw vicious gangs of boys as young as 8 harassing people. North Korea is reportedly plagued by the same phenomenon outside of its showcase capital. That may be an indication of what lies ahead. In fact, what terrifies South Koreans more than North Korean missiles is North Korean refugees pouring south. The Chinese, for their part, have nightmare visions of millions of North Korean refugees heading north over the Yalu River into Manchuria. Obviously, it would be reckless not to worry about North Korea's missile and WMD technologies. In August, there were reports yet again that Kim Jong-il was preparing an underground nuclear test, and the North test-fired 7 missiles in July. According to U.S. data, 3 of the missiles were Scud Cs, and 3 were Nodong As with ranges of 300 to 1,000 miles, all were capable of carrying a nuclear warhead. Whether North Korea has such warheads is not definitively known, but it is widely believed to have in the neighborhood of 10, and the KFR certainly has the materials and technological know-how to build them. The third type of missile, a Taepodong-2, has a range of 2,300 to 9,300 miles, which means it could conceivably hit the continental United States. Though the Taepodong-2 failed after takeoff during the recent testing, it did so at the point of maximum dynamic pressure, the same point where the Space Shuttle Challenger exploded, and the moment when things are most likely to go wrong. So this is likely not an insoluble problem for the KFR. The Seven Stages of Collapse. Kim Jong-il's compulsion to demonstrate his missile prowess is a sign of his weakness. Contrary to popular perception in the United States, Kim doesn't stay up at night worrying about what the Americans might do to him. It's not North Korea's weakness relative to the United States that preoccupies him. Rather, if he does stay up late worrying, it's about China. He knows the Chinese have always had a greater interest in North Korea's geography, with its additional outlets to the sea close to Russia, than they have in the long-term survival of his regime. Like us, even as they want the regime to survive, the Chinese have plans for the northern half of the Korean Peninsula that do not include the dear leader. One of Kim's main goals in so aggressively displaying North Korea's missile capacity is to compel the United States to deal directly with him, thereby making his otherwise weakening state seem stronger. And the stronger Pyongyang appears to be, the better off it is in its crucial dealings with Beijing, which are what really matter to Kim. To Kim's sure dismay, the American response to his recent missile tests was a shrug. President George W. Bush dispatched Christopher Hill, his Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs, to the region, rather than Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. I was in South Korea during the missile firings, and there were few signs of alert on any of the U.S. bases in Korea. Pilots in several fighter squadrons were told not to drink too much on their days off, in case they had to be called in, but that was about the extent of it. What should concentrate the minds of American strategists is not Kim's missiles per se, but rather what his decision to launch them says about the stability of his regime. Middle and upper middle level U.S. officers based in South Korea and Japan are planning for a meltdown of North Korea that, within days or even hours of its occurrence, could present the world, meaning really the American military, with the greatest stabilization operation since the end of World War II. It could be the mother of all humanitarian relief operations, Army Special Forces Colonel David Maxwell told me. On one day, a semi-starving population of 23 million people would be Kim Jong-il's responsibility. On the next, it would be the U.S. military's, which would have to work out an arrangement with the Chinese People's Liberation Army, among others, about how to manage the crisis. Fortunately, the demise of North Korea is more likely to be drawn out. Robert Collins, a retired Army Master Sergeant and now a civilian area expert for the American military in South Korea, outlined for me seven phases of collapse in the North. Phase 1. Resource depletion. Phase 2. The failure to maintain infrastructure around the country because of resource depletion. Phase 3. The rise of independent fiefs informally controlled by local party apparatchiks or warlords, along with widespread corruption to circumvent a failing central government. Phase 4. The attempted suppression of these fiefs by the KFR once it feels that they have become powerful enough. Phase 5. Active resistance against the central government. Phase 6. The fracture of the regime. Phase 7. The formation of new national leadership. North Korea probably reached Phase 4 in the mid-1990s, but was saved by subsidies from China and South Korea, as well as by famine aid from the United States. It has now gone back to phase three. Kim Jong-il learned a powerful lesson by watching the fall of the Ceausescu family regime in Romania. Take utter and complete control of the military. And so he has. The KFR now rules through the army. There have been only individual defections of North Korean soldiers to the south. Even small, unit-level defections, which would indicate that soldiers are talking to one another and are no longer afraid of exposure by comrades, have not yet occurred. One defector from the North's Special Operations Forces told me that soldiers in the ranks are afraid to discuss politics with one another. The North Korean People's Army is simply too big to be kept happy and well-fed, so the regime concentrates on keeping the elite units comfortable. The defector I spoke to, a scout swimmer, told me that while the Special Operations Forces live well, the extreme poverty of conventional soldiers would make their loyalty to Kim Jong-il in a difficult war questionable. Would they fight to defend the KFR if there were an unforeseen rebellion? The Romanian example suggests that it depends on the circumstances. When workers revolted in 1987 in Brasov, the Romanian military crushed them. When ethnic Hungarians did so 2 years later in Timișoara, the military deserted the regime. How to prevent another Iraq. Stephen Bradner, a civilian expert on the region and an advisor to the military in South Korea, has thought a lot about the tactical and operational problems an unraveling North Korean state would present. So has Colonel Maxwell, the chief of staff of U.S. Special Operations in South Korea. The regime in Pyongyang could collapse without necessarily its army corps and brigades collapsing, Maxwell says. So we might have to mount a relief operation at the same time that we'd be conducting combat ops. If there is anybody in the UN who thinks it will just be a matter of feeding people, they're smoking dope. Maxwell has conducted similar operations before. He was the commander of a U.S. Army Special Forces battalion that landed on Basilan Island in the southern Philippines in early 2002, part of a mission that combined humanitarian assistance with counterinsurgency operations against Jamaa Islamiya and the Abu Sayyaf Group, two terrorist organizations. But the Korean Peninsula presents a far vaster and more difficult challenge. The situation in the north could become so messy and ambiguous, Maxwell says, that the collapse of the chain of command of the KFR could be more dangerous than the preservation of it, particularly when one considers control over WMD. In order to prevent a debacle of the sort that occurred in Iraq, but with potentially deadlier consequences because of the free-floating weapons of mass destruction, a successful relief operation would require making contacts with KFR generals and various factions of the former North Korean military, who would be vying for control in different regions. If the generals were not absorbed into the operational command structure of the occupying force, Maxwell says, they might form the basis of an insurgency. The Chinese, who have connections inside the North Korean military, would be best positioned to make these contacts. But the role of U.S. Army Special Forces in this effort might be substantial. Green Berets and the CIA would be among the first in, much like in Afghanistan in 2001. Obviously, the United States could not unilaterally insert troops into a dissolved North Korea. It would likely be a four-power intervention force, the United States, China, South Korea, and Russia, officially sanctioned by the United Nations. Japan would be kept out, though all parties would gladly accept Japanese money for the endeavor. Although Japan's proximity to the peninsula gives it the most to fear from reunification, Korean hatred of the Japanese makes participation of Japanese troops in an intervention force unlikely. Between 1910 and 1945, Japan brutally occupied not only Korea, but parts of China, too, and it defeated Russia on land and at sea in the early 20th century. Tokyo may have more reason than any other government for wanting to put boots on the ground in a collapsed North Korea, but it won't be able to, because both China and South Korea would fight tooth and nail to prevent it from doing so. Whereas Japan's strategic position would be dramatically weakened by a collapsed North Korean state, China would eventually benefit. A post-KFR Korean peninsula could be more or less under